Okay, today I'm here to talk about entrepreneurship and profit. First thing we can say about the entrepreneur is that his face should be on a milk carton, because he's been missing from neoclassical economic theory since World War II. If you've had microeconomics, whether it's principles or intermediate micro, you'll note that there's almost no mention of the entrepreneur in the micro book. Okay, and this is a basic theory of how prices are formed and how firms operate. And yet, there is no entrepreneur mentioned. They talk about the capitalist investor who supplies money to the firm, but really doesn't have an active part or role in the firm. They talk about the manager who runs the firm, making his own decisions, no one overseeing him. And they talk, of course, about labor and owners of natural resources. But they don't talk about the entrepreneur. Okay, sometime in the 1930s, he went AWOL from economic theory. Okay, never from Austrian economic theory, but from economic theory. The Austrians begin with the notion that any action takes place under uncertainty. Okay, even if I pick this glass of water up, expecting that I'm going to get a nice, cool, refreshing swig of water, and Chad happened to spike it with vodka, okay, maybe that would be better or worse, but it would be different than from what I expected. So, as Mises says, all action is embedded in the flux of time and involves speculation. Now, we're not even talking about the business realm yet. I'll get to that. We're talking about action in everyday life. First of all, remember, all actions take time. Okay, from making yourself a sandwich to putting an addition on your house. It takes time and is aimed at the future. Secondly, the costs and the benefits that you expect in the course of this action, okay, before you begin the action, are uncertain. Let's take an example of that. In fact, we'll take an example very close to home, which is attendance at the Mises University. Okay, you had certain expectations when you decided to attend this university. During the course of the week, these expectations may or may not be met. Okay, you might be very, very sorry that you made the choice to come here and be bored by me, maybe, and others, especially by DiLorenzo. But in any case, you compared the alternatives, the alternative use of your time and resources. Okay, even putting money aside, just the time that you've taken to attend this week. We can look at it in the following way. Obviously, by attending, you have shown or demonstrated, as Austrians would say, that you prefer to be here to any other alternative use of this week's time. So you did rank Mises University first. Okay? And you may have given up the chance to work at your summer job, if you're a student, let's say $400. Okay? So you gave up $400 wages. Or you could have spent the time camping with friends, which was third in terms of value, and so on. And there were other obvious alternative uses of these week that would have brought you satisfaction. Okay, so in this case of this individual, foregone wages of $400 is the cost of the Mises University. Or actually, maybe I should have done it this way. We should have maybe this camping was your next best alternative, because I don't want you to think that cost is always in monetary terms. So if camping was second, then it would be the cost of attending a Mises University was the foregone satisfaction from camping. Okay. But this is all uncertain. When you make the decision, the benefit, which is the expected satisfaction from Mises University, is always greater than the cost. In this case, the foregone camping trip. So the benefit's greater than the cost. When benefit's greater than cost, we have, in Austrian terminology, a psychic profit. You gave up something of lower value in order to receive something of higher value. Yeah? Yeah, we're going to get to that.
Okay, so yeah. We're still
Yeah. In fact, I'm going to introduce a Latin word right now, a Latin term, ex ante, from before the action is completed, okay? From before. The benefit is always greater than cost. Otherwise, you wouldn't voluntarily agree to forego camping and go to the Mises University. Right? But because of the lapse of time, because you never know, you have all the information about the future that is necessary to predict what will happen, once you get to the completion of the action, you can get either of these. Benefits could be greater than cost, in which case, ex post, after the action, from after, you've earned a psychic profit, or benefits could be less than cost. In other words, you may have thought that you were going to get some sort of middle-of-the-road approach to economics here, but you find it's an extreme criticism of neoclassical economics. You didn't expect that. You don't like it. So you wish you had gone camping. You regretted your decision. So your benefits were less than your costs. Okay? So you were a bad entrepreneur. Some people are better than others in making decisions in their lives. Okay? Which means then that ex post, you can either earn a psychic profit. That is, you use your means in a way that you were satisfied with, that brought you the greatest satisfaction, or psychic loss. Psychic loss can occur even if you are, you know, enjoy the Mises University, but you determine afterwards that you would have enjoyed camping with friends better. That's a psychic loss. Because you used a scarce resource, a week of your time, to achieve an end that has a lower value than, let's say, the Mises University, that has a lower value than an end you could have achieved at that same time. Okay. Also, in terms of money, an aunt, and you're the favorite nephew, leaves you $2,000 upon her bequeath to you, $2,000. You can do many things with that $2,000. Let's say you could you'd go on a cruise, okay, or you could buy a laptop, or you could spend the money over the next year, let's just say partying. Or you could, you know, you could save it for graduate tuition. You rank these alternatives according to which you believe will give you the most value. Okay, so on. Okay, you'll always choose what's highest on your value scale. You'll use the $2,000. If each one of these alternatives absorbs $2,000, you'll use the $2,000 to go on the cruise. Okay, and if you're satisfied with it, then you'll earn a psychic profit. If not, you'll earn a psychic loss. Now, the point then that I'm trying to make here is that every action involves an entrepreneurial element because of uncertainty of the future. And psychic profit and psychic loss is logically anterior or logically prior to monetary profit and monetary loss. We have to explain how an everyday action, profit and loss, arises before you can grasp how it arises in the business arena. So now we come then to the concept of what Mises called the promoter entrepreneur. Okay, even though everyone is an entrepreneur, even when you choose to go to a college, okay, we see that many people regret their choice of college. We know people that might even go to, transfer maybe twice and wind up going to three different colleges. Why? Because they're not good predictors or forecasters of how that college experience will turn out at that particular institution. So I'm sure in your own lives you've made decisions that you regret, and you might have friends that are consistently better at making decisions in the sense that they're always happy with their decisions than other friends. Okay. So what Mises points out is that this difference in people's ability to predict and adjust their actions to future changes and conditions is a datum of human action. Some people just happen to be better than other people at it. You know, some people are always regretting their decisions. Others are very happy with it. Most of us regret some and are happy with other decisions. Okay. Those people that are consistently have greater foresight are people that tend to be better entrepreneurs in the business realm as well. So Mises then refers to entrepreneurship when it takes place in the business arena, and he talks about the promoter entrepreneur to distinguish it from the pure entrepreneur. The pure entrepreneur is the element in action. It's not a real person. When we talk about pure entrepreneurship, we mean it's the element in action which involves people speculating about the future. So all of us, in some sense, are entrepreneurs. Okay, even when we try to choose different jobs, or when we choose what to do with our resources in everyday life, there's pure entrepreneurship. But Mises is interested in a narrower category, at least for economic theory, the promoter entrepreneur. Let me say a few words about the word entrepreneur. If you go back and it was actually discovered or written about very early on in 1734 by Richard Cantillon, who Murray Rothbard considered to be the founder of economics. Okay, at that point in time, the term entrepreneur was used. It was coined in French. When it was translated in the 19th century into American texts, the word undertaker was used. That is someone who undertakes new organizations of business, someone who introduces new products, someone who undertakes new projects that yield new goods or the same goods with using different technology. By the 1920s, the term undertaker came to denote the mortician. So in the 1920s and after that, they imported the French word entrepreneur back into the English language. In some texts, you actually see enterpriser, okay? Those people who start the enterprise. Well, Mises uses the term promoter entrepreneur, okay? The promoter is someone who promotes new businesses, new ways of doing things and organizing things. You would call, obviously, Bill Gates a promoter. Ray Kroc, who began the McDonald's chain in the early 1950s, is a promoter. Dave Thomas, who gave us Wendy's, is a promoter, and so on. Okay, these are men with big visions who have the ability to carry out the steps necessary to implement those visions. And also, those visions are based on correct expectations of the future. Okay, so that's the promoter entrepreneur. And we can define his specific function. Okay, the promoter entrepreneur determines the employment of the factors of production. In other words, he or she alone decides what will be produced, how it will be produced, what technology will be used, where it will be produced, what location, okay, and how much and what quality. So those ultimate decisions are made in a business by the promoter entrepreneur, not by the managers. We'll talk about the difference between managers and entrepreneurs a little bit later. Now, that means that entrepreneurship is a pure decision-making function. It is not a factor of production. If the entrepreneur is mentioned in micro texts and neoclassical texts, they say, well, he's just another factor of production. Okay? Maybe it's a type of labor. So entrepreneurship, you need entrepreneurship as well as capital and labor and land. That's not true. The entrepreneur is not on the same level as capital, goods, or capital, labor, and land. The entrepreneur is the one who makes decisions about how these things are used. Remember, the laborer always gets paid wages, no matter how unsuccessful the business is. Okay? So when Continental recently went into Chapter 11 and United Airlines went into Chapter 11, their employees still got paid all along. Okay? It was the entrepreneurs that took the losses. So what I'm getting at here is that if the entrepreneur was a factor of production, he would always get paid. But in fact, he actually can get paid a negative income. Okay? And that's not true. There's no such thing as negative wages or negative interest or negative rent. Right? So the entrepreneur has to be different from these other, what we call, factors of production. Okay? He is not a factor of production. He's the one who makes a decision about how to use these factors of production. Okay. Now, that means if you're a decision maker, you have to forecast the future. If you want to introduce a new model car in the U.S., it takes about 7 years. So, you're not interested in what the price of similar models are today, or what they might be today. You're interested in what the market for automobiles is going to look like 7 years from now when these cars are on the dealer's floor. Right? Now, if you're in Japan, it only takes 5 years. Okay, but still, there's a lapse of time. Even if you're starting up a small business that you can have up and running in 6 months, you still have to forecast what the demand will be in 6 months. Not only that, the demand is going to change over time. So if you foresee this business running for 10 years, you're going to have to forecast supply and demand over the course of 10 years. Okay, so there's that function. You have to be able to forecast the future. It's very important. Another function is that you have to be able to bring together the factors of production. There's is sort of a, what we might call an ownership function, right? Mainly that involves hiring managers to carry out your entrepreneurial plan. Also involved in entrepreneurship is the fact, or the circumstance, that after the plan has been implemented and the goods come onto the market and are sold, the entrepreneur bears the sole risk. He or she is the residual claimant. That is, after all wages are paid and rents are paid and interest is paid, what's left over, okay, is the entrepreneur's. So they have a claim on whatever is left over after all costs are paid. Now, that might be negative. So you'll sometimes see in neoclassical texts the term residual claimant used to indicate the function of the entrepreneur. No one else bears the risk. As I said, no matter how unsuccessful a company is, WorldCom, Enron, okay, no matter how unsuccessful they are, ultimately, the workers have gotten paid at every step of the way because workers get paid in advance. They're always paid before the product is sold on the market. The engineers that are coming up with a design for a new automobile that's going to come on the market 7 years from now, they're paid every 2 weeks or every month, years in advance of the sale of the product. Who's the one who's left holding the bag, as we say, if the model fails? If the model is like an Edsel, the 1958 car that was a spectacular failure, the decision for which, by the way, was the same person that got us into the Vietnam War, Robert McNamara, Secretary of Defense. He was the president of Ford at the time. Now, let me point out also that it's difficult to forecast the future because not only must you forecast future demand and supply, but you must appraise prices, meaning you must have an idea of how people's incomes will change over time, how their tastes will change, and not only that, what will that mean for the actual prices that emerge when your product comes on the market? So we use the term, when you're trying to decide how events that will occur will affect prices, we talk about appraising prices, meaning that we're going from qualitative knowledge about certain events that will occur and certain changes in tastes, and the introduction of maybe new technologies and so on, how do those qualitative events affect quantities, meaning prices? Okay? That is another task of the entrepreneur that's very, very important. They have to appraise future prices. So let's take an example here. 1980-1981, I mentioned this in another lecture, IBM lost $5 billion. Okay? In 1980 and 1981, the big three auto companies lost $5 billion in total, Ford, GM, and Chrysler. And Chrysler was on the verge of bankruptcy, but Lee Iacocca, if you, the older ones among us here remember Lee Iacocca, appealed to the federal government, who then bailed them out. They guaranteed loans from banks. So Chrysler would have collapsed. Chrysler had gone out of business. Consumers did not buy their product. In 1992 and 1993, in those 2 years, IBM lost a total of $13 billion. Okay, now, What happened? How could they lose that much money? Well, what happened was, and I don't know if Bob Watson was the founder of IBM or just one of the part of the family that founded IBM. IBM had actually come up with the PC technology in the 1970s. But Watson said in the early 80s, he said something like, PCs will only be a toy for households. Okay, kids will play games on them. Maybe some people will use to arrange their household affairs and stuff. But they will never catch on in business. Okay, so that was the CEO and the entrepreneur running the largest and most successful firm, in the electronics industry at the time, saying that. There was a guy in a garage who knew about this technology, Steven Jobs, who started Apple, who said the contrary. He said, no, I think in 10 years, in fact, what's going to happen is that PCs will be widely used in business. Computers will not be custom made as they were being done by IBM. IBM's, if you recall, their motto used to be, we sell solutions, not products. But Steven Jobs said, I think that computers are going to become like commodities. Okay, everyone, which all use the same software and are customized after they're purchased by the user, and he was right. Okay, so we've got Apple being very successful, and then we got others that use the PC technology. Tandy was one of the initial companies. There was Compaq and so on that introduced PCs, so that IBM had made a number of decisions in the early 80s, which was to go forward with continuing to develop the mainframes, so that by the early 1990s, they were locked into producing and selling these mainframes, which were not selling, which were selling for prices much below the cost. So if the mainframe cost $2 million a piece to produce, they're selling for like $1 million or something. And that's how they lost $13 billion in 2 years, which up to that point was the biggest loss for a company in industrial history. Okay. So we'll come back to that. One other point I want to make is that some economists, for example, Israel Kirzner, who's written extensively on entrepreneurship and was a graduate student under Mises and got his PhD under Mises, claims that the entrepreneur is a pure entrepreneur. It's simply someone who makes decisions and who's more alert than other people, who sees differences in prices. So the example he gives, or the analogy he gives, is that there are $10 bills floating down, let's say in this room, and only a few of us are alert enough to reach out and grab them. Okay? And all profit is simply someone who is alert to opportunities that other people do not see. But that implies that people are that production is atemporal. There's no time involved. That person says, the costs are low of the product, and I can sell at a high price. So I'll buy these things, I'll make something, and I'll sell at a high price. Okay? It doesn't take into account the fact that time is involved, that you must have capital today and speculate about what price will be in the future. You're not alert to price differences. You have to appraise what prices will be before you can compare them to your costs. Now, in Israel Kirzner's model, can the entrepreneur ever suffer losses? No, because he doesn't have any capital. He's just someone who buys low and sells high. Okay, he's an arbitrageur, right? Someone who buys tomatoes in one area because they're 25 cents a piece and sells them in another area because he notices that they're 35 cents a piece. And he makes an arbitrage profit. So there is no such thing as a pure and penniless entrepreneur. An entrepreneur also must always have some capital at his disposal, or some people willing to loan him the capital because his idea is so good. Okay, in any case, he's always open to suffering losses. In fact, I think Roger Garrison came up with the saying, once a pure and penniless entrepreneur, always a pure and penniless entrepreneur. You don't have any capital. You can't take advantage of these future opportunities that you forecast, because you always have to pay the factors of production in advance to get them to do anything for you. Okay. Now, what about managers? Okay, let's talk about where managers come into this. The entrepreneurs determine the general plan. Like Bill Gates, for example, determines generally what Microsoft is going to do, let's say, in the next 5 years. He has a plan for the next 5 years. However, especially in a huge company like Microsoft, he's going to be faced with changes over those 5 years that he hasn't anticipated, okay? But which will not undermine his plan completely as long as he adjusts to them. And that's the manager's job. He can't be everywhere in that company. So he hires managers. Managers are, in effect, junior partners of the entrepreneur, okay? Their incomes depend on how high profits are in their segment of the firm. That might be through bonuses. They might get higher bonuses that are tied to profits, okay? Or it could simply be that their income fluctuates, or their salaries fluctuate. Okay. Depending on how well their department does or their division does. But what does distinguish the managers from the entrepreneurs and makes them only junior partners is, can the managers lose money? No. That's why managers are not entrepreneurs. Okay? They can share in the profits that they help generate. They can't lose money. Okay? There's always a base salary there. And they're also paid in advance. They can be fired if they don't do well. And they will be fired if they don't do well. But that has nothing to do with them getting paid prior to the product that's been produced. We're going to talk about that. You're absolutely right. I mean, they can, but there are ways of reining in the managers. But that's a very good point. So how do entrepreneurs in general control managers, or how are they able to hire these people and just give them pretty much free rein in their departments and units and so on in the firm? Well, the fact that we have double entry bookkeeping or accounting. Okay, once you have accounting, you can very, very clearly and finally see which departments are making profits, which departments are responsible for losses, and how much of these profits and losses they're responsible for. In other words, the entrepreneur is able to set up profit centers and cost centers. In other words, through economic calculation, they can determine the contributions of various units under the managers they hire. Even down to individuals that are hired. Okay, they can estimate the marginal revenue product, which I think Dr. Klein may have spoke about yesterday and when he talked about the firm, okay, in production. So, there's no problem with entrepreneurs knowing what managers are doing, but as has been pointed out here, managers have different goals. Managers want big offices, okay, which raises costs. They want access to the company helicopter, which raises costs. Okay, they want a company limousines to pick their kids up and take them to school and take them back from school. They want high pile rugs in their offices and expensive art on the walls. They want two pretty secretaries, let's assume it's a male, for the moment, where one competent secretary will do. Okay? So their managers get satisfaction from raising costs and spending that money on themselves in addition to their salary. Now, how do you stop them from doing those types of things? Especially in the corporate firm, where ownership is dispersed among hundreds of thousands of stockholders. That is, the entrepreneurial function is dispersed. Okay? And most of the stockholders are involved in their own daily activities and businesses and jobs and so on, and are not able to monitor the firm. There is a board of directors that supposedly does represent stockholders' interests. But there generally are a few large stockholders in a firm, okay? So let's look at a firm where there are, a sort of Bill Gates firm, where there is, one huge stockholder who wields a lot of power, and then a firm that may be like GM. And usually firms where stock ownership is widely dispersed and where managers have free reign tend to be inefficient, okay? But, so in the case of the Bill Gates firm, Murray Rothbard gave a very interesting example. He said, and this was in response to John Kenneth Galbraith, the left-wing institutionalist economist who claimed that American firms in the 1950s, or actually 1960s, he claimed that American firms, in his book, The New Industrial State, are not run by the owners and in the interest of the owners. They're run by and for what he called the technocracy. These are the high-level managers and engineers and scientists that ran the firm. Okay? So he claimed that they ran the firm in such a way that there would be some dividends and profits, but for the most part, they ran it in a way that benefited themselves. Well, Murray Rothbard pointed out the following. Let's take a multimillionaire. Let's take Bill Gates, who has a huge estate that he goes to every weekend, and he has a head landscaper, okay, who takes care of all the landscaping. He really doesn't know much about landscaping, and he's not only there on weekends, or maybe he's there once a month, and he doesn't. He lets the guy do what he wants. So now, if you're observing that, if you're John Kenneth Galbraith, and you don't have too much of an imagination, not too creative, you say, wow, this guy doesn't run his own property. It's the head landscaper that's running the property, that's determining the whole layout. But, of course, we know Bill Gates one day shows up and doesn't like what he sees. You know, if the guy is using, patterns of flowers and shrubbery and so on, that he likes and that are easy to put in and that minimizes his work, but Bill Gates doesn't like, Bill Gates obviously can just fire him. Okay? The same is true with managers where there's a strong entrepreneurial presence in the firm. They can simply just be fired. Okay? But now, let's take the harder example, okay, which Galbraith also deals with. What's to prevent managers who may or may not be part owners, who are paid in stock bonuses, and what's to prevent them from running the firm in their own interest? Okay, that is running up costs by having all these perks. Well, the point is there's a couple of things, or there's three things. First of all, the board of directors, okay, to the extent that they get paid for the performance of the firm, if they're outside directors, can fire the managers. Okay, but even more directly, there can be proxy fights. That is, a disgruntled group of large stockholders can get together and they can challenge the current board of directors and management at a stockholders meeting and call for a vote on the board of directors and send out literature to the small stockholders who then will give them their votes by proxy, okay, if they're not satisfied with the returns they're getting. And to make a long story short, they can vote the current board of directors out, fire the managers, put their own board of directors in. Okay? That happens sometimes. But most importantly, okay, the way that managers are forced to operate the firm in the interests of the entrepreneur stockholders and not themselves is through the capital and money markets. On these markets, there's something that we call a market for corporate control. In other words, other firms can simply buy up your stock. If they think they can use the assets, the capital goods, that your firm comprises better and increase the profits, they will simply buy the firm up. Okay, so there's a market for corporate control. And this happened in the 1980s. In the form of what we call hostile mergers. So, if the managers of a particular firm are running the firm in a way that is, the value of the firm on the stock market is dropping, if stocks are dropping in price, okay, that's going to make it a very good target for a hostile merger. So let's say that the firm's total price, capitalized value on the stock market is $10 billion. Okay? That's the value of all the outstanding stock. And there's another company that's run by very efficient managers, or even by an entrepreneur, who sees this and says, wait a minute, you know what? With the same assets, I can run that company more efficiently. And in fact, I can increase stock prices by 50%, so that I know I can increase stock prices by $5 billion in total, which would be a huge $5 billion profit. So what that person would do was simply go in and begin to buy up stocks of the firms. Now, unfortunately, the federal government had got involved in the 1960s with the Harrison Act. If a firm wants to buy up another firm, it has to want to buy the stock of another firm. It has to give, 60-day notice. It can't purchase more than a certain amount, which gives the incumbent management time then to go to the stockholders and begin to claim that, they'll do a better job. This is a bad deal. Okay. And it was very interesting. In the late 1980s, there were a lot of letters to Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, bemoaning the fact that American managers had to be very short term. They had to make sure that they maximized their stock prices because of hostile takeovers. And that this wasn't the case in Japan. That's why Japan was more efficient than our economy. The Japanese economy was more efficient because their managers weren't subject to this sort of harassment. Their managers could plan for the future. But of course, a stock price reflects not just profits today, but what? Profits, the stream of profits into the future that are discounted back to the present. Now, who usually signed these letters? The CEOs of firms that were targeted for takeovers. Okay? So the hell with them. I mean, they were inefficient. Hostile mergers supports the interests of the consumers, because what they'll do is to get those stock, they'll bid the price up to, let's say, $12 billion. They'll still make a profit, but the current stockholders will do better also. So Galbraith is wrong. Where you have a thriving stock market, you're going to have firms, corporate firms, run in the interests of the owners and the entrepreneurs. Okay, now let's go on to what profit is. Okay, you more or less know what entrepreneurship is and what the function is. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, well, see, yes, I think they are, in fact. Even bondholders have a certain say in the firm, right? Because bondholders have a prior claim on the assets if the firm goes bankrupt. Okay. What's that? Yeah, they're the capitalists, but they're also, anytime you invest in anything, you're putting your money at risk. So you are bearing some of the risk of the firm. Now, they're not the promoter entrepreneurs in Mises' sense. That's much more narrow. Those are the people with a lot of capital that make the decisions. Okay. And somewhere Mises says that it's very, that the great firms are run by these hands-on types like Bill Gates, Ray Kroc, Dave Thomas. He doesn't use those examples. He was writing earlier, obviously. Henry Ford. Okay, those are the most successful firms. And after a few generations, they become less and less successful. Okay, when they go public, and then the stock ownership becomes diluted. Okay. Yeah. I made a mistake. He actually, in a way, is, but it's a very small. But he does. I had an omission. What I wanted to say was that what drives the price of the stock from $15 billion down to $10 billion initially. And that is the small shareholders saying, I'm getting out. So you have that one decision, sell. If you sell, okay, as small shareholders sell their stocks, that drives the price down. Supply is greater than demand, so price has to fall. Okay, and when that happens, it makes the firm a better and better target for a takeover. So small shareholders have a function, an entrepreneurial function. But you're absolutely right. They don't have the control over the factors of production that the promoter entrepreneur has. There's more work has to be done on this distinction. Yeah. Okay, let me just talk about profit now. Because, again, profits are a very confused concept in economics. We define profit, and I'm going to use the Greek symbol pi for profit because we use that in economics. We use p to denote price, so we use pi for profit. Always equals the difference between the total revenue that you receive and the total cost. Okay? But here's where the difference between the accountant and the economist comes in. The accountant and the economist differ on what is included in total cost. Total revenue is pretty straightforward. When you sell the product, the total proceeds, the price of the product times the quantity, of units you've sold yields the total revenue. Okay, but total cost is a little bit more complicated. Let's assume that we have someone who is a landscaper, small landscaper, and that person invests $100,000 out of pocket. Let's say it's his own money. He doesn't borrow from the bank. It's his own savings. In hiring workers, in buying the necessary shrubbery and tools and so on that are needed for landscaping. At the end of the year, his landscaping services generate $140,000. Okay, and forgetting about depreciation for a moment on any equipment that may be owned, the accountant would say that profit or net earnings is $40,000. But the economist would have to know more. Okay? The economist would have to know if this guy managed the firm himself or not. Okay? So let's assume that he did. Let's say this individual managed the firm. Well, you have to account for the value of his services. Okay? Let's assume he didn't draw a salary. He just managed the firm. And so at the end, he had the $40,000. Well, in fact, how do we account for the managerial services he provides to a small firm? Okay, he's the owner and the manager. Well, we call that foregone wages. How do we determine his foregone wages? You look around and he finds out what's the next best employment opportunity. What's the best employment opportunity I am giving up in running my own firm? Well, he might be able to manage someone else's firm and earn a wage of $50,000. Well, that has to be included in total cost. He's foregoing $50,000. Let's say he also uses his own truck that he had purchased. Okay, so there's a foregone rent of the truck, meaning he could have rented this truck out on the market, and let's say that he could have gotten $5,000 per year for leasing this truck out to another firm. Well, that you have to account for that also. And finally, of course, he's used his own money. So there has to be some return imputed to this money. But let's say he could have, make it very simple, that he could have put it in CD at 5% or something like that. Well, 5% of $100,000 is $5,000. So there's foregone interest. So that's $60,000 of what economists call implicit costs. It's also sometimes called normal profit, but that's not a good word. We don't like to use that word. But you'll see it in some of your texts, normal profit. Implicit costs is a better word. So now you have to add the $60,000. So the economist, the $60,000 of implicit costs. Okay, the other costs are explicit out-of-pocket money costs, $160,000. So in this case, the entrepreneur, in a real sense, lost $20,000. Meaning the following. Okay, you might say, well, that's just a paper loss. He really earned $40,000. No, he didn't, because if he had not started this firm, if he left his money in the CD, his funds in the CD, if he rented the truck out to someone else, and if he went to work for someone else, at the end of the year, he'd have his $100,000, okay? Plus, he would have $50,000 of income, $5,000 of rent, and $5,000 of interest. So he has, in effect, suffered a loss, okay? Now, let's say he just earns $160,000 in revenue. His profit, his economic, what we call economic profit, or sometimes Austrians use the term pure profit. His pure profit is zero. But will he continue to run the firm? Yeah, no, yes he will. Why? Because he gets return for his managerial labor, he gets rent on his truck that he would have gotten elsewhere, and he gets his interest. As I'll show you, the market economy tends to wipe out pure profits, to drive them down to zero. Or if there's losses, to drive them up to zero, because it drives firms out and decreases supply and raises price. Okay? So this is what the market's always driving towards. But because of continual change, there's profits and losses reappearing continually. Okay? The excess of total revenue over all costs, explicit and implicit, okay? We never reach the long run. Let's put it this way. In the market economy, there's a tendency pure profit to equal zero. Because if he's earning, let's say he was getting returned $180,000 of total revenue, So he's earning pure profits of 20,000. Okay? Then other people in the area, or someone else in the area, will begin to compete with him and will drive that down, cause prices of landscaping services to fall, and drive the his total revenues down to his total costs. Okay? Well, I'll give you some examples of this. Okay, now, in a minute. Okay. Oh, great. There's one other point. I want to make another point here. What is the source and the function of profit? Okay, where does profit come from? Well, it comes from uncertainty of the future. Certainty and change. That's the source of profit. That's its source. If every entrepreneur knew exactly what the prices of all goods will be in the future, there would be no profit. So, for example, just to give you a real concrete example, if I hold up, I don't have many of these, but if I hold up a $20 bill, okay, and you know, with certainty that I'll give you this $20 bill, and I ask, I want to auction it off right now, what will be the price of this $20 bill? Almost $20, with a small margin for any effort you have to expend in walking up here. Okay, right? Now, if all entrepreneurs knew exactly the prices, their price tag on everything in the future, and they knew it, they would bid up the costs of the factors up to what? Right up to the price, leaving a little margin for interest because it takes time to get that income in the future. Okay? So if you know the future perfectly, there is no room for profit. Would there be businesses? Yeah. Because they would still earn a normal rate of return they would cover all of their implicit costs. Okay? So that's the source of profit. What's its function? Its function is the key here. We don't want to focus on the fact that profits tend towards zero. Okay, that is a tendency. What we want to focus on is that whenever profits arise, it's because something has changed, and up to that point, no one has seen this change. Right, so let me give you an example.
When you're saying profit, you're saying pure profit.
Yeah, I mean pure profit. Because sometimes this interest return is called long-run profit. There'll always be some long-run profit, a return on your capital. Okay? So in your textbooks, they'll talk about what Austrians call interest or natural interest, return on your investment. They'll call that long-run profit. That is not what we're talking about when we talk about profit. Okay? We're not talking about this equilibrium state where the future is, everyone knows the future, and the only return anybody gets is a normal return that is equal to everyone else's on their capital. That's evenly rotating economy, exactly. That's a return for waiting, okay? That's a return on capital, right? Not on debt. No, you're getting it as the entrepreneur.
But I mean, it's in finance.
Yeah, in finance, it's a
return on debt.
Yeah, right. But just be careful because Austrians always look at interest as not something the firm pays, but something the firm receives for investing capital, because the capitalist is the entrepreneur plus all the bondholders and everyone else. They all participate as and risk their money. Okay? So everyone receives interest, even the entrepreneur. Even though legally he has to pay the bondholders interest, he's also receiving interest for his capital investment. Okay. Now what's the function? The function is to continually shift resources from lower value to higher value uses. So the bunch of independent filmmakers that got together back in the late 90s and spent $60,000 to produce a film called The Blair Witch Project. Okay. Then they went on, they did sell it to a company that distributed it for about a couple million, but they spent very little. And that generated $50 million. So the price minus, okay, total revenue minus the total cost, is $5 million. 50 million, I think, earned. Yeah. Okay. What they did was they took resources, the film, the camera, the the labor of very unknown actors. They combined them. Okay? Had they not stepped in, the actors and so on would have earned $60,000 elsewhere. The film would have been used and generated a product that was, that was part of the $60,000. It would have been used in lower value uses to consumers. They combined it in a new way, and they shifted the resources from a low value use, $60,000, to a high value use, $50 million. Mel Gibson did the same thing with Passion of the Christ. That cost about $40 million to make, total cost. So, had Mel Gibson not bought those factors of production and ultimately decided how to use them, okay, those laborers, those actors, and so on, okay, all the inputs necessary to produce a big-time movie like that, they would have generated elsewhere about $40 million. Why? Because he had to buy them, he had a bid against other entrepreneurs. And in their estimation, these inputs could only generate $40 million of revenue. He had a better idea. He combined them a different way, and I think now it's over half a billion dollars. I think with foreign distribution and so on, it's video and so on, it's $500 million. Okay? So he benefited not only himself, but consumers by making a much more valuable product than would have been made without his intervention. Okay? One of my favorite examples is the woman who used to work for IBM. Incredible way she became a millionaire. Her name was Tomima Edmark. And basically, I'll end with this example, I think, here. She was, in August of 1989, she was a Dallas-based IBM mainframe saleswoman. Okay, so, it's kind of scary because it's, right at the end when they're starting to lose a lot of money. And so one morning she thought her long blonde ponytail looked a little drab. But she found she could braid her ponytail by using a makeshift device consisting of a plastic loop and a knitting needle. Okay. So she was wondering, could other people use this product? And she decided, she thinks they would pay for this product. Okay, very simple product, plastic and a knitting needle. And so she was 32 years old at the time. She plunked down $5,000 to get a patent on it. And she called it a Topsy-Tail. Okay, I remember it was advertised for a while on TV back then. And so what she basically did was she went to a small company in New Jersey and to pitch this to them, and they turned her down flat. Okay, so she decided to produce it herself. She paid for a mold using $9,000 in savings. She still worked for IBM at the time. She found a plastic maker who would produce as many Topsy-Tails as she needed for about 50 cents a piece. So her average cost is 50 cents. Okay. Profit is also equal to price minus average cost times the quantity of units you sell. Because Q times P is your total revenue, Q times AC is your total cost. All right. So she plunked down 50 cents. She ran an ad in April 1991 that brought in orders worth $1,000. So she filled them herself. She stuffed the envelopes in her own apartment. By the end of 1991, she was moving 200 units a month and selling for $10 each. Okay, so look at this now. So she's getting $10, 50 cents. You might want to add in her implicit labor costs, whatever that could be, price. She's making a huge profit here, a per unit profit. Then she was in New York on IBM Business, and she persuaded Glamour magazine, big women's fashion magazine, the editor to try Topsy-Tail, the female. She liked it so much that she featured it in the 1992 issue of Glamour. Within 3 weeks, she had $100,000 worth of orders and had to enlist her cleaning lady to help her stuff 400 envelopes each week. Then a big break came. IBM fired her, gave her a pretty nice severance package. She took $25,000 early retirement package, and she lived off the money, and she hawked her product. So then she realized if she went on TV, she could really generate some interest in the product. And she was turned down a number of places, but she finally found a small TV products company in New Jersey and that promoted things like kitchen gadgets and sunglasses and so on. So they agreed to put together a two-minute commercial. So with that, Topsy Tails television marketing, print advertising, and retail distribution, they're going to oversee all of that for her. Now, on her own, before she went to this company, she sold 250,000 Topsy Tails at $10 a piece. That's $2.5 million already for the TV stuff in 20 months, okay, with only 50 cents per unit. Okay, so she's already a millionaire here. Okay, the commercial hit the networks in December 1992. She sold 3.6 million at $15. Okay, cents. Okay, so now she's a multi-millionaire. Then she went on QVC network. She sold 5,000 at $15 each in 11 minutes, in the first 11 minutes. Okay, so you get the idea. What did she do? She took a product that would have generated revenue from consumers of 50 cents, okay, valued by consumers at 50 cents a piece. She turned it into a product that they valued at $15. Okay? And she became a multimillionaire. Now, is that the only way to earn profits by introducing a new product? Absolutely not. The other way to earn profits, oh, by the way, she immediately had imitators, and eventually what happens? As imitators come in and they increase the supply, the price is pushed down, and eventually this happens. If it goes on long enough. Assuming that includes implicit costs, you know, you can sell them, but you're just earning a regular return on your capital. Okay. What's one other way for you to earn profit? Well, to make goods at lower and lower prices, to make the same good at lower prices. When hand calculators first came out, I remember as a graduate student, they came out and they were selling, Texas Instruments was selling theirs at $350, okay? This is before the microchip revolution. This was 71, 72, you know, and it was expensive to make these things. They're big and, you know, they could barely add, subtract, and multiply. They couldn't even divide. Well, they could, but. So let's say that the average cost was $100 price. All right, now, other companies began to come out with these product, and then the price quickly fell. Okay, so by mid-70s, $100. And you know what happened. What kept happening was that people kept finding, because of the microchip revolution, better and better technology they were using to produce these things, so that the first firm to introduce the new technology may have decreased costs to 50, and they would decrease their price to 90, they'd have a big profit, and they would begin driving other firms out of business. These other firms would then have to copy their technology. And you know what happened? Ultimately, you pay $5 now for a hand calculator that can do way more than the original one that was selling for $350. But once again, there's always a tendency that now there's just a normal profit being earned, or what you know we call normal profit, long run interest rate, whatever you want to call it. Okay, it doesn't mean people stop producing hand calculators; they're still getting a normal rate of return. Same thing happened, I don't know if I'm going to have time for this, but same thing happened with ballpoint pens. When they first came out, they were a luxury item. They came out in 1946. I have a story here, but it's too late to really tell it. And what happened basically was that they came out at a price of $20. Now, that's $20 in 1946 dollars. It's hundreds of dollars. You know, it's something like leaving a BMW in your driveway nowadays to impress people. You left a ballpoint pen on your coffee table and you had guests over to show how, you know, it was conspicuous consumption. By 1948, they were selling for 89 cents or 69 cents or something like that. Because so many companies came in, all right, and drove the price down. So what I want to end with is, what is the source? It is a quarter after, right? Yeah. Now we start at 10:15. Okay. So what is the source of profit? Okay. Is profit ever normal? No. Profit's not a normal part of the market economy. What profits indicate is that there is a maladjustment. This is what Austrians stress. In what is produced and what should be produced to best serve consumers. So anytime you see profit, it tells you two things. The wrong things are being produced, and there is somebody who has realized this and is just beginning to produce the right things. A good example is, and I'll end with it, is that if there's a remote region, let's say somewhere in Appalachia, and there are a number of doctors on the edge of this region, and people begin coming to these doctors, and one doctor in particular, Dr. A, notices that this is an epidemic. It's going to spread. So he rushes in, and he sets up his clinic, and he's right. So within the first week after he sets up his clinic, he sees a lot of people, makes a lot of money. Well, people tend to blame him for earning high profits. But of course, the real source of the profits is the following. That the other doctors that were seeing these people didn't recognize or forecast that there would be an epidemic. If they had all come in at the same time, would this guy have made profits? No, it would have been a normal rate of return. So, it's not the guy who makes profits that should be blamed, because he's beginning to adjust supply to demand, to increase the supply of medical services. It's the companies that don't see the profit opportunity that you can blame. Now, they'll come in later on because they see he's making money, and eventually, of course, the medical service will be driven down in this area, and profit will be wiped out. But you can't really even blame B, C, and D, because then why didn't you see it? You know, in other words, why didn't someone else step in? But you certainly can't blame A. Okay? So just keep in mind then that profit is not a return to a factor of production like wages, rents, or interest. Profit is a result of a pure decision making, a pure decision. Okay, if your decision is correct, you earn profit. If you correctly adjust supply to demand, you earn profit. If it's incorrect, you suffer losses. Okay, I'll stop there.